You're listening to The Printcast, a podcast about the expanding world of printmaking. I'm your host, Nick Naughton, a master printer with 20 years of experience bringing you news, interviews with contemporary artists, and timely stories from around the print world. The Printcast is an inky finger on the pulse of what's happening in print today, and I'm grateful to have you with me. Hello, print world, I'm back. How are things? I'm going to skip the awkward stuff that my inner child wants to say to you, but just know that I'm excited to be getting back to the show. Today I've got a great conversation to share with you featuring an artist you may recognize from Instagram as The Printmaker and Her Dog. Or for you non-social media people, her name is Kari Christensen. Kari is a relief printmaker based in Vancouver, Canada, where she pumps out iterations of her stylized landscape prints. Kari has a great presence on social media, and there's something really appealing about the type of work she does. It's simple, monochromatic, and presents a field of view that makes you want to jump in and get lost amidst the lines and dots that she carefully renders. We get into topics around the origins and influences behind her landscapes, lots of Canada-related discussion, of course, and we share some love of our favorite papers and relief printing methods. Speaking of relief printing, there are a couple of priceless tips today in our Let's Get Technical segment, so hang in there because you won't want to miss them. Just a reminder that subscribing to the Printcast means that you won't miss any of this printastic content. You can look forward to my next interview featuring Yunmi Nam, professor and printmaker at KU in Lawrence, Kansas. Also, you can support the Printcast on Patreon at patreon.com/theprintcast for only $3 a month. It's great to be back, and I hope you enjoy today's episode of The Printcast.
Like, the work is inextricably tied to lino printing. I think that when I first started doing printmaking, of course, I did a variety of printmaking, and then but the lino printing was always my one true love. And I think that's because it's been done very traditionally for a really long time, and I think that you can say contemporary things with it. Part of, like, working thematically for me is trying to solve problems in lino printing, like trying to see what I can say, like, just with line.
You're listening to The Printcast, Season 2, for sophisticated arty types.
When I think of the landscape and art, so many different things come to mind. The soft-hued paintings of Georgia O'Keeffe, the dramatic vistas of Yellowstone seen through the lens of Ansel Adams's camera, or even the depictions of Mount Fuji in The Prince of Hiroshige. Despite my broad exposure to the subject, I find myself drawn to a contemporary print artist's take on the tradition of landscape. You may know her on Instagram as The Printmaker and Her Dog, but a more appropriate title might be The Printmaker and Her Land. In print after print, artist Kari Christensen creates graphic geometric compositions depicting sharp angular peaks and fantastical landmasses draped in shadows. The most unusual part is that it's all created using a simple language of lines and dots. Kari is joining me today on The Printcast to discuss her prints, what it's like making a living as an artist in Canada, and the role that her dog plays throughout it all. Kari Christensen, welcome to The Printcast.
Hey, Nick. Nice to be here. I love your podcast.
Yeah, thanks for coming on. I've been looking at your stuff for a long time, and something about, I don't know, you're always posting, like, new compositions and new work. It's like, it seems like you're putting out new pieces, like, weekly or something. Like, how much output do you have?
Yeah, I'm pretty busy. I try and do at least one or two a month, at least. I try and aim for, like, one a week, but the bigger linos, they're around 20 by 20. They take me 30 or 40 hours to carve. So, and I always do a study ahead of time as well. So it depends. Yeah. So I try and do one a week, but it's more like one every 2 weeks.
That's a lot still. But you do, like, really short editions, right? I saw, like, you only make, like, a couple, two or three prints per piece, and then you move on.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think that's part of me trying to, as a printmaker, compete in a world of painters for the most part. Trying to keep print more valuable. I mean, I think as printmakers, we know a lot of people don't understand printmaking in general. A lot of people, you know, you hear the word print and they don't understand the process behind it and how much work goes behind it. So I think we're still, like, as a genre, kind of undervalued. So one of the things that one of the approaches I've taken is to do really small print runs to try and up the value of the work. So that's why I do the small print runs. And then I often tell people too that by the time I'm done with the 30 or 40 hours of carving, before that, there's all the planning and all the prep work and all the other kind of stuff. And then the printing itself, by the time I get to that end process, by the time I'm printing, I'm so over it. I just want it to be done.
Yeah. Well, then,
I've mentally moved on.
Well, so then you're always looking on to the next thing, right? Like you're happy with the thing you just accomplished, and then but you're always looking towards the next thing that'll be better, maybe.
Yeah. Well, I think, and when you're working, you always get ideas for the next print while you're working on the one that you're working on. That's just the best way to describe it. Like ideas just come on top of other ideas usually. So yeah, I don't suffer from a lack of inspiration. That's for sure.
Yeah.
Well, how much do you know about Canadian landscape art?
Well, you know, I've been reading up. I'll be honest, not a ton. I know of like Group of Seven and things for sure from like my art history, but I don't know. Maybe you can explain more of what it's about. Like I could give my like Cliff Notes version of what I know right now, but you probably know more.
Right. I think so I live in British Columbia now, which if people know Canada very well, I moved basically from one side to the other. I grew up in Ontario. I spent my first 30 years in Ontario. And Ontario, in and around Ontario, in and around Toronto, that's where this giant group of painters called the Group of Seven. I mean, I say giant, they weren't giant people. They were just regular men. In the Canadian landscape tradition, they kind of started it. Like they were seeing impressionist movements and stuff in France, and some of them traveled to France and Britain and stuff like that. And then they brought it back to Canada, but they wanted to reinterpret it in a Canadian style. Like they wanted to show like our mountains and the things that happened here that they felt were different and lacking in a tradition here. So that was them. And all their work was based in and around Ontario, areas in Ontario. Now, I also grew up in a tiny town, like a really tiny town just outside of London, Ontario, where there was a Canadian art movement. And I laugh a little bit when I say that because there's not a whole lot of Canadian art movements. We're still kind of young for that. But there was an art movement in the 60s and 70s. Called London Regionalism. And what it was a bunch of artists reacting, I'd say like partially they were reacting to our proximity to the United States and saying things that, so they wanted to say things about where they lived as opposed to reacting and doing work that represented places like New York and Los Angeles and things like that. They wanted Canadians to talk about what it was like to be Canadian. So that was the idea of London Regionalism, was to pick these artists, this group of artists picked like London, which is basically nowhere in Ontario. This is a tiny little, you know, city. And they put it on the map. So growing up there, like when I was a teenager, I would go to some of their shows and things like that. And I was really inspired. It gave me this whole idea that if they had something that they could say about where they were from, then surely I could add my voice to something from where I was from. Like, it was just like, it was one of those seeds of inspiration that was planted a long time ago.
Yeah, and I was wondering, because that has to have a lot of meaning too, being in Canada and trying to search for like what a Canadian voice might be or what a Canadian art world is and how that stands up. Because as I read about it and learned about it today and past couple days, it just made me kind of question like again, like the whole canon of who is important in art history and how edited that is and how it's not really a reflection of the quality of work going on.
Where is going on? Like where are you raised?
Yeah, and it's like maybe you're doing scenes that are like of where you live, but for some reason, like New York is like the center of it all, especially back when they were kind of pushing their movement forward. And from what it looked like, they were also just like doing things that they wanted to do that were more their own creative choices versus following like trends that happen, you know, especially like in the earlier art world. Now it's kind of anything goes, but you know, back in the day, it's like you had to be on trend or you were irrelevant and forgotten, you know, and overlooked kind of.
Yeah. Yeah. That's an interesting point too. And I think like, you know, like Group of Seven, that was back in the 20s. They were reacting to Europe being the art scene. And then I would say London Regionalism, they were responding to the United States being the art world. So I think, yeah, it's just like Canada trying to forge its own identity is a thing that has taken a lot of time. Like maybe slower than most other places, I'd say. We had like one of our most important prime ministers, Justin Trudeau right now, his father, Pierre Elliott Trudeau. And he said, he likened it that living in Canada with it being next to the United States was like sleeping with an elephant. You know, you feel every twitch.
Yeah. Well, I see. I don't want to get into politics, but I see how just like the shit going on here, like plays out on like all the front pages of papers everywhere. Like I see like, you know, news in Canada, but it's talking about like our president or whatever. And it's so just like over dominating. And I don't know. It's got to feel weird, like being in Canada and like watching that influence kind of continually kind of flex into like, your airwaves and your culture. And I don't know, like, how do you maintain like your Canadian voice, or how does that come through in your work, that your work is uniquely Canadian?
Well, I think like one of the things, like educating yourself as an artist here, you have to like, you kind of have to go out of your way to educate yourself about Canadian art, because in like, I went to the University of Guelph and my degree's in art history, and you don't study any Canadian art history at all. You study American art history or European art history. So I like any of the education that I got about Canadian art history was mostly throughout my own education, right? You have to like, you had to go out of your way to make it happen. I mean, I think that's just the way it is, right? So I think that probably fueled for me this desire to want to say something about Canada. I always thought that art was just this big collective and we all just added our voice to it. But I realized that, you know, when you break it down a bit, you're like, the most important thing about your voice is that where your perspective is from. Like you growing up where you did, not probably learning about the Group of Seven in high school, for example, like we did, which just seems bizarre to me, right? Like it seems outside of like you were totally studying different people than we were.
Yeah. No, art, yeah. But, you know, honestly, as I thought about, and this is something I wanted to ask you about, like, I grew up in Iowa, so, like, kind of very central U.S., but, like, on the northern end of the central U.S., you know? And so, growing up, like, for some reason, we always thought we had the most neutral accent, you know? I don't know why we were all very proud of sounding, like, very neutral. We didn't have any inflections of, like, the South or, like, anything like a Boston accent or anything prominent. But the one thing that comes through once in a while is a little bit of a Canadian inflection, or, like, North Dakota, like, the O. And I wondered if life in Canada was kind of similar to Iowa. Like, it just seems, I don't know, like...
It's funny that you talk about accents, because my girlfriend is Australian. And when we first met, of course, she has an Australian accent. It's very different than how we talk. And we talked about my accent. And I said, well, I don't have an accent. My accent is just like the absence of an accent. And she laughed so hard that I would think that. So yeah, for sure. Obviously we share the same. Yeah. What do you mean? I don't have an accent.
No. But yeah, but growing up for us, we had a similar like regionalist like training in our world. It was like, if anyone important in the art world or doing anything, frankly, science or anything, like if they came from Iowa, we all would know about it. And there'd be like articles written about,
for sure,
this proud scientist who worked on something off in a foreign country. Like, but he's from Iowa though. So like he's our people. And, totally. Like in art, it was always Grant Wood was like the big one, you know, it's weird. Cause like I rejected it when I grew up and was around it and was taught about it. But then like, as I got older, it's like his art became very meaningful because it came from where I came from and because it resembled things I had seen and known my whole life.
There's this one artist, one of the jobs, the many jobs I've had over my life is I worked at a bookstore, and there was a local artist. He lived in Guelph, and his name was Ken Danby. Now, most Canadians know who Ken Danby is, but anyone else is probably going to have to Google him. He has a couple of very famous images of hockey players. Like he's got one called Lacing Up, and it's a close up of someone doing up their skates.
Yeah.
He's very famous here. Anyway, I remember working one day in the store, and I was at the special orders desk, and this man came in. Of course, I recognized him, but I wasn't sure it was him. And he came up to place his special orders. We're talking about his book, and I'm like, he's like, here's my name, Danby, and then the first name Ken, and then I was like, do you mean the Ken Danby? Like, and I got, you know, I had that fan moment of that, you know, that local artist. But he was very popular.
I don't know. There's something about it. So I understand it on a level, I can say. But in your landscape work, you're always like, you're abstracting everything. And it's mostly you're kind of inventing these landscapes, right? Like I know a few you've done that are representative of some peak or something, maybe for a reason, but.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I think there's definitely been an evolution in the landscape that I've been working on. And I'd say it's like, it's just this general evolution. Like when I started working on like making up my own language around lino printing, I'd say that I started out by doing things that I'd seen before, you know, like reinterpreting scenes that I'd already seen. And then I moved into creating my own landscapes. I think like an artist, a lot of artists do that in general, right? Like a lot of artists, they copy other artists, you know, to learn. And then a lot of artists end up doing, you know, pictures of things that they're familiar with around their home, also very lovely. And then, you know, you move on to doing the things that you want to see.
What drives like these iterations? Like, are you like making little thematic groups to explore like a set of problems, or are you I mean, is it just like each one just informs the next, or, you know, how do you do it? Do you divide it into little bodies of work and like sets, or do big things come up that like maybe cause you to pivot and create a new body of work that you weren't expecting?
Yeah, I mean, I'd say like the work is inextricably tied to lino printing. I think like when I first started doing printmaking, of course I did a variety of printmaking, and then, but the lino printing was always my one true love. And I think that's because it's been done very traditionally for a really long time. And I think that you can say contemporary things with it. Now, a lot of people, like, I can only speak for, again, education here. Like, we started doing lino printing when I was in grade 7. And most people lino print or block print as a jumping off point into other printmaking. You know, they move on to etching and screen printing and things that sound way cooler and are also very cool. So I, for some reason, I know why, like I'm drawn to lino printing, but then I just think, so part of like working thematically for me is trying to solve problems in lino printing, like trying to see what I can say, like just with line. Now that's, I often get a lot of questions about why the color choice, like why monochromatic? And again, it's because I'm trying to draw attention back to the line work and just to see like how much I can say just with line, well, which turns out to be lines and dots. But so I think like, so in answering your question then in a very roundabout way, I'd say it all falls upon, like I do end up doing like slightly different bodies of work where I'm trying to introduce things into like light or sky or shadow for one. So it's all exploration of line. That's what I'd say.
What's like the most meaningful, like real landscape in Canada? Are there places like nearby that you treasure that kind of are in your mind when you're doing all this work?
Oh, I mean, like Vancouver is surrounded, we're surrounded by mountains.
Yeah.
And I remember that, I mean, it just made this such an impact. The first time I came here on vacation, I stepped out of the plane and I looked up and it was just like, I cannot believe people live like this. Like the mountains are constant companions around you. So I often think about, there are these two lions. There's like, every time you walk outside here, you see them and they're called the two lions. And it's just part of the Vancouver landscape. But yeah, the Rocky Mountains, they're all here, right?
I was going to ask you about the region up there, like Granville Island. I know I saw in some of your earlier days, you were in Granville Island. And I looked it up and it said something, it had some incredible quote about it. It was like the printing press capital of Canada or something like that.
Well, when I first moved here, like when I first came on vacation, I put my name on a wait list to be in a print co-op on Granville Island. And there's two print co-ops on Granville Island. And there's also, I think, the only master printmaker in the area. He works there.
Yeah. Is that Peter Braun?
Yes, it is. Do you know him?
Yeah, I actually do. Oh. Small world, but like it randomly, it was like years ago when SGCI was in Portland, I went down to that and my friend had coordinated like a few people. We would all like stay together and somehow randomly one of them was Peter Braun. So I got to like hang out with him like the whole trip.
No way.
Yeah,
That's
was great.
So funny.
And he actually, he raved about the island, and I've been wanting to go visit ever since I met him that time. And he was talking about the abundance of printing presses. Again, it came back to that again. Like he was just like, if you need like a Vandercook press, I can get you one for like $2,000. There's like hundreds of them everywhere. And I couldn't wrap my head around it, but can you like expand on why there would be an abundance of printing equipment in your neck of the woods in that part of Canada? Like why? Like what's
It's so funny, eh? That's funny. I bought my first printing press off of like when I, because I was in the printmaking co-op for about 10 years.
Yeah.
And then I decided to start my own studio and I bought my first press off of Peter. It was like one that someone had handmade like 20 years ago.
That's
so I
nuts.
Bought my first one from him. That's so funny. And anytime I have any questions about anything, he is like a wealth of knowledge.
I do the same thing because I'll see him like, you know, steel plating, like etching plates and doing all kinds of like that really high level, like technical stuff that I haven't yet tried, you know, and like he's always open to like talk about it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. He's a really good source of knowledge. I'd say, I don't know, like there's a lot of schools here that teach printmaking. I'd say with the two printmaking co-ops, there are a lot of printmakers up and around here. And I mean, the press that I work on now is actually made on Vancouver Island, really close to here. And it's a really affordable printing press. So there are just a lot of them around here. And I think there was a school that shut down a few years ago and they had a printmaking program. And so that released a bunch of presses out into the wild. And I think, you know, like Peter is one of those people that like he buys them and then resells them. And like he fixes them up, and because a lot of people have them sitting back in their sheds and things like that. They have no idea what they are. And so he fixes them up and then sets them out again. So yeah, I mean, I think that would explain Granville Island. Yes, it's two printmaking co-ops. It was the only ones in British Columbia.
Yeah. I love knowing people like him who are like, I don't know. There's something about it's almost like in every community that's big enough, and if there's enough printing going on, like there are these people like him who like are the locus of where if new equipment comes into the world or it gets sold or someone needs to get rid of it, it's like they somehow find the same few people, like Peter or like back where in Kansas City, there's this guy Calvert Guthrie, and Calvert like any printing press like showed up on the scene, like it went through Calvert somehow, or he would like turn it on to like someone who was looking for that machine And oftentimes he would keep them, so we'd all just be like, oh, that machine that we're looking for, you just got a third one for free from somebody who's just needing a home for it. You know what I mean? Like, there's always these figures who magnetically draw equipment to themselves. And they take care of it, you know?
Yeah, and I was very fortunate, too. I think the first one I bought from him was only $2,000, which, I mean, if you know anything about buying etching presses, that's a pretty good deal, right, for a pretty big press. So yeah, that it's pretty great. He also runs, have you heard of Bimpy, the biannual miniature print exchange?
Oh yeah,
Peter Braun, that was his it's his baby.
Yeah, god,
yeah, they're just accepting, like, little plug, they're just accepting, they're accepting submissions right now.
Oh cool. Yeah.
I could tell you another like Peter anecdote. I ran into him, like, we talk frequently, but I was doing a mural on Granville Island a year ago, and I do mural work as a way, it's like, it's just like one of those side ways to make money as an artist. But I do try and spread like the printmaking word out there, because I want even my mural work to be somehow associated to the print work that I do. So my murals look exactly like prints. So they mimic all the same carving lines that I do in the lino. So I did the image of the Vancouver landscape, with the two lions and the mountain landscape, the view from my house. It's actually on a wall down in Granville Island, and Peter walked by and he's like, that looks like a print. I'm like, thank you. You got it.
You'll always get that from a printer. Yeah. If they see your drawing and they see a certain characteristic, they're just like, you should be making etchings. Like, they'll just like pitch it right at you.
Right. Right.
Well, yeah, I was going to ask, I don't know, I had a bunch of things. I saw that you were diagnosed with like an OCD condition called erythmomania.
Yes.
And yeah, and I wanted to hear more about that and how that, I don't know, just how that factors into your life, but like if it affects your art in any unique ways or how that plays out in your process and whatnot.
I think for sure it does. I think it explains a lot about why I'm drawn to lino printing. I mean, because lino printing, there's like very set specific things you have to do to make the print work out. And so I'd say for sure, like process wise, that OCD has led me to really appreciate that kind of process. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah.
And then I'd say the counting stuff. And I mean, I've been counting and putting, like, erythmomania is basically you, like any room and stuff that I enter, I'll put things in order according to size and I'll count them repeatedly over and over again, things like that.
Yeah.
And I've been doing it since I was a child. I don't remember ever not doing it. So I think when it came time to expressing like the line work and the dot work, really repetitive line work and a whole lot of dots really make me happy.
Yeah, no, I think it's so interesting. And you can see it just in like the almost like mathematical precision in your print work, that you're carving all these like really tight parallel lines. But you're not like using a ruler or anything really mechanical, right? You're just like carving kind of eyeballs,
freehand.
Yeah, freehand, straight line.
That's one of the questions I get the most, is how do, from like a lot of other printmakers on Instagram, for example, the question I get asked the most is, how do I keep the lines so straight? And I must use a ruler. But of course, I think as anyone knows, like the printmaking gouges are V-shaped. So if you put those up against a ruler, you're just cutting the ruler basically.
Yeah.
So yeah, no. So I draw the lines on ahead of time and then freehand them. So it's just like, I think it's just a lot of concentration and going really slowly. And then, you know, having done it for over 20 years now, I think you just like your hand starts to be really familiar with how the tool feels, you know?
Yeah. It's almost like you hit a grain, I don't know, something about, you hit like a flow with it and then you just kind of push it through and it generally goes kind of straight. I always found, cause you can do really awesome like parallel line work on lino cut.
By the way, like I think like when people ask me like why lino more than anything else, well, at first I just would have said, you know, you love what you love kind of thing, but I think the OCD and the counting, I mean, it definitely plays into why I picked it for sure. And why something, you know, and I say air quotes around something messy like etching wouldn't appeal to me, right?
Yeah. Well, it leaves a lot more room for chaos. And like in relief, you really can like dial it in to where like it's very predictable. You know what your pressure is, you know, like it's more predictable outcome. I was going to ask though, because I saw that you were almost wanting it to look digital, but then have it be a print, you know? And I was thinking like, why not just make it digital? And I know you were talking about in different interviews and stuff that people ask you, like, why make it a print if you're hiding the fact that it's a print by making it so clean and so flat? And I was wondering what you thought about that.
You know, I think it's an interesting thing to talk about because I think, well, for one thing, I think it's important that work like that can be done by a human still. Like, you don't need to do it digitally, right? Like, we don't need to rely on these processes to do this. Like, I can actually do this with my hands. And I think that's an important message to get out there to people. And I think it's important to do. But I think that's the other thing too about like seeing the work in person and seeing it online. Like, when you see it in person, it is so obviously done by hand. Like, you'll see all the imperfections, and you'll see like that little bit of ink that caught on the edge of the plate when it was going through the press. You'll see that the lines aren't exactly straight. So there is that whole difference between seeing something digitally and seeing something live that makes it quite different. Like, I think when you see them, they're quite alive. But I'm not upset when people say, oh, is that done digitally? That doesn't hurt my feelings at all, because I think that's the moment when you can really turn around and educate someone about print. Because mm-hmm. I think that we're taking this process that was, yeah, for sure, invented to make things easier, like to do posters and to spread, like, you know, messages and things like that. And we've made this beautiful art out of it. So yeah, that is possible. Yeah. And I think like you could get a lot of that with, that you're probably familiar with Dave Leffner as well. Like, you can make it look as realistic as you want it to look, but there's still like a certain hand-done thing to it that is unmistakable.
Yeah, and especially in relief, because it's like it's there or it's not there. It's like once you carve it away, it's gone, and it's very positive, negative based.
Yeah.
Did you have any ideas for Let's Get Technical?
Technical.
Ooh. I could say a few tips and tricks about how I get such solid backgrounds and how I make the lino lay flat.
Yeah, yeah. Do you like heat it up or something, or what do you do to keep it flat? Do you use Battleship Gray also?
I do use Battleship. Okay. Yeah, I think it has the best line quality. But it comes in a big roll, right?
Yeah.
And you have to buy the entire roll, and the longer that you own it, the more curly it gets. So one of the things, and of course, anyone who does lino printing at all knows that the death of a relief print is when it moves as it's going through the press. So you want to mitigate movement as much as possible, or you want the movement to go in your favor. So there's always that. But anyway, mm-hmm. So I break the backing, so you can actually if you get lino and it's curled at all, instead of heating it, because the heating will change it slightly. Yeah. You can hear it start to crack as you start to bend it back against itself, and you can hear light cracking sound, and that's when you know that you've slightly broken that burlap backing, and it'll lay flatter. It takes a bit of time, but if you do it, the whole thing will lay completely flat.
Hmm.
And then the other thing that's really important that a lot of people, something that I wish someone had told me years ago, is that linoleum needs to be sanded before you use it, because it has a very rough surface. There's oils and stuff that are left on it. You can tell the difference. Like, once you wet sanded some lino and not wet sanded, and you rub your hand over it, you can just totally feel how unequal the unsanded one is. And it it's smooth and supple and takes the ink in a really nice way.
See, that's what I'm talking about. Cause I've done, like, I did a huge chunk of lino at one point, and like, so it was my material of choice for sure. And yeah. And I used like I think we had big hot plates at the time. So I would just throw it on a hot plate and kind of warm it up, you know, which is like the standard for, especially when it's hard to carve and like, or curled, you know, but you're right. It does turn brittle. So mm-hmm. I think your idea is actually probably better in the long run, cause it won't, you know, whatever chemically dries it out or something when it heats up too much.
Yeah. And I think the other thing too is like, if lino is hard to carve, that just means your knives aren't sharp enough. Like, it just means you haven't, like, you have to, like, I keep the honing strap. Flex Cut makes a really great honing strap for lino. You can buy the file tools, but the speedball tools are also really good as long as you are constantly honing them. So you have to, like, you know, every three or four cuts, you're completely like making sure that blade is kept really sharp. Mm-hmm. I can use like one of those like those $2 speedball blades for almost 2 years.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I would say it's probably one of the most like economically, like, I don't know, efficient tools or something out there. Cause like even, yeah, with all the other nice tools I own, if I do like a lino cut, like I'm absolutely going to use their little tool set for like the entire thing. And I don't know why, cause I have equal, like I have the same sizes and nice, like, you know, woodcut gouges and stuff that I've invested in. And for some reason it just works, like, especially their tiny,
the little number one blade.
Yeah. The little number one, it's just like gold. Yeah. It just cuts so clean. And
yeah, that's all the dots right there is the little number one blade.
Yeah.
I would say, but you know, like I love their carving tools, but when it comes to their printing tools, I'd say like, cause I upgraded probably about 5 years ago into getting, start using Tkatch rollers, mm-hmm. and that has made a world of difference. I like the Speedball rollers, the brayers, they're fine. But when you use the Tkatch ones, it's just, you can't even explain how much better it makes it.
Night and day. No, it's definitely one of the best investments. Just for reasons I can't explain, but the rubbers and things that they use with their Tkatch rollers are just, they're just perfected. And
creamy.
And the Speedball ones, honestly, they play a different purpose. Like, I wouldn't make it like your professional, like, big inking roller, but like, keep a dozen on hand for like when you need to do a ton of multicolor stuff, or if you're going to teach a class, or like,
print,
you know,
a t-shirt.
Yeah, like all kinds of reasons. Like, they are the best tool, and you can like literally throw them in a bucket together and pull them out, and they basically function fine like later too. Like, you know, like you don't have to take care of them the way you would like the nicer brayer, where it's like you're going to make sure you set it the right way and like, you know.
Oh yeah. That thing goes in a locked cabinet when I'm done with it.
Yeah. Yeah. Mine are kept in little boxes, like hidden away in a closet somewhere. Like they're all just like protected and, you know.
Yeah.
But I feel like, do you feel like with a roller, with a nice roller though, you have to get it out and use it occasionally, kind of like a nice violin, or like, can it sit forever? This is something I think about.
No, I miss them sometimes when they're,
yeah.
I pull them out and I talk nice to them.
Yeah.
I'll let people, like, I'm always happy to let people, like my studio mates and stuff, like they can come in and use my press, but no one's using the rollers. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Gotta get your own.
It's too hard you can't replace that very easily. It's too expensive, you know?
And I always like sharing tips and stuff with people. Like when we have this big event here called the East Side Culture Call that happens every year, and thousands of people tour the studios. And people are always asking me for tips and tricks. And then other artists will say to me, why are you letting people know how you do what you do? And it's just like, I think it's like, who cares if you know how to do what I do, though? Because the important part is like what I bring to it. Like my ideas are the thing that's the most important thing. And those I can't give you. Right.
Yeah.
So if anyone wants to ask me tips and tricks about things that I do and what paper I use and what ink I use, I'm more than happy to tell them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I'm with you. I like sharing as much as I can. Like, there's a point where you can cross a line, I guess, asking people for like too much information and whatnot. But I think that's what I've learned so much from other people, and like just like a trick to like sand my linoleum. Like, I don't know why it didn't occur to me. I know you should like sand wood and other surfaces if you're going to print from them. But like, that's like a new thing that I can try out that'll probably actually help, because I've always been really annoyed with like, with all of the stuff you described, the greasy texture.
It's slightly dip-balling, right?
Yeah. It's absolutely there. Yeah, it's like orange peel.
Dry sandpaper. Make sure you get the black one and give it a little squirt with water.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I would always do like extensive, especially after all carving is done and I'm like about to print, like I would always do like this crazy round of like degreasing, which I always found was like priceless and made everything work. Because otherwise the ink wouldn't adhere. Yeah. And I think you're probably getting the same effect doing what you're doing, but it was something where like ink would go on and like just like almost be repelled by the surface in a way I could never figure out. And so I would just take alcohol and like wipe down the whole block and degrease the whole thing. And then ink would stick to it perfectly every time after that. And so you have to like look for those little things, or it's just going to show up and make your work look bad, you know?
Yeah. It's just one of those things that, because you don't want people to get turned off. And it's just like one of those simple things that, because if you make one the first time and you have like some success doing it, you'll go back and do it again.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think like, it's important. I think like hand printing is fun, but you have to use like really lightweight paper to make it worthwhile. Right.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
What kind of paper do you like? Do you like thicker stuff or Japanese or?
Yeah. I do all my own framing too. That's one of the things that like when I first, started making art, I had a friend who taught me how to frame. So I frame everything too. So, and as someone who frames work, I like the slightly thicker paper. I think it's a bit more luxurious too. If people buy your prints, unframed, and a lot of people still do because that's what they can afford. Mm-hmm. I like the slightly thicker paper. I just think the longevity over time, I just think it's really good quality paper. I use Arnhem. It's that company that Speedball bought a few years ago, Arnhem 1618 paper. Hmm. So it's like, it's not as thick as say a Reeves BFK. It's probably like 245 GSM, but it's still a nice paper, really nice paper.
Hmm. Would you say, have you ever used American Masters? Or I don't know, would that even be available up there?
I've never heard of it.
That's like a brand, like a Blick brand, like Dick Blick, the art company. Yeah, they put out their own line kind of to compete in the same way. It's like a little bit cheaper and, but like, you know, they have papers that'll work for like intaglio and relief and screen print and kind of multi-purpose sort of papers, but.
Yeah, what's the cost of paper like down there? Like, cause for example, like I do one of my series I do is combining screen printing and lino printing. And so I use the Arches 88. And up here, Arches 88 runs between $8, $9 a sheet.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the same?
That's about the right. Yeah, it's about the same here, I think. I mean, that's just like an amazing paper. Like when you look at that one, it's just designed so perfectly.
I have an 88 tattoo.
Yeah. Like you've got
the only printmakers would get it, you know?
Can I get it to look like a watermark on my arm, like
exactly,
where it's barely visible?
But I think like, so the Arnhem is that it's roughly $4 or $5 a sheet. So if I have a bad printing day and I screw up, it still makes me like, you know, want to like step on my foot a bit.
Oh yeah. Yeah. What do you do with like, I was wondering, so if you're doing like short editions, what do you do with all your blocks? Do you keep all of them just like stashed away or what do you do?
Oh yeah. I've got all of them. There's a big pile of them. I have it back to the first one I ever did in grade 7. I can't throw them out. I know technically you're supposed to score them and make them so no one else can use them, but
yeah,
I just have a giant pile of them. I think they're fun to bring out when you go to shows and when you have people in the studio. They're important to have around so then people, you know, they can touch it and then they can it gives them an idea of how it was done. A lot of people like they get that aha moment the minute they can put their hand on it and feel that you've carved into it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I agree with that. Do you, when you're selling work to people, like how do you go about it? Do you have shows like, you know, gallery show type thing? Do you do fairs, like studio crawl things where they come to you? Like, what's your best way?
So I've been a full-time artist now probably for 8 or 9 years. Before that I had a job, but I'd say like, and the important thing to do, how I do it up here and a lot of other artists do it, is to have like multiple sources of income at this point. So there's I think I mentioned it before, the East Side Culture Crawl. There's this big studio event. Thousands of people, like 5,000 people come through your studio on a weekend. It's pretty amazing. 5 to 10,000 people. And I'm in this really cool old factory building. It used to be like a mattress factory. And so it's a very cool building. There's probably 300 to 350 artists in the building in total. So it's pretty cool.
Wow.
So there's stuff like that where people come to the studio. There's a few events like that. I'm also part of the local art gallery here called the Vancouver Art Gallery. They have an art rental program. And so they have some of my framed work. And so it gets rented out for film and video work and for catalogs with furniture companies. And people can also rent it for their homes, which is pretty cool. It's a pretty affordable way to have like a rotating art collection.
Wow.
So I'm part of that. And that, so then you get rental income and sales income from that.
Does that generate like quite a bit, or like how does that go? I've never done anything
like
that. Yeah.
It does. It's just like this good solid thing that you get paid for every 3 months. Like you take, like they've got, you know, 10 or 11 of my works and they just randomly, and sometimes you get to see, like they'll also arrange shows and stuff like that. Like right now there's a show of my work down at the Law Society. Well, where no one can see it, sadly.
Yeah.
But, it's pretty cool. And it's a good solid, they pay quarterly. It's pretty solid way for an artist to make money.
Yeah.
So there's random things like that. And then I'm in gallery shows, and then I'm in a gallery in Toronto that represents me and has my work. So there's multiple ways of money. And I think like one of the more important things for me too is like, I think especially now, having an online presence. I started doing that a couple years ago, but having an online shop now has really been important through Instagram.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's, it's also a really good way to sell work. I mean, you have to work at it, and it's not my forte, of course, as an artist, but that's why I have someone who helps me.
Yeah. Well, that always helps for any of us who can't do it all. So I went on your website and I saw like you had a few featured works that were available. So like, you know, I saw like a small list there, but then if people want more, when I clicked through, it went to like a pretty elaborate store. Like you had like all the bodies of work and every type of piece listed there, right? Like, what do you use? Do you use like Squarespace or something like that? Or what do you, Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, Squarespace. And I think like I have, yeah, I think like when I first opened the online shop, I just like filled it with everything that I had available. But then I have an artist consultant. She actually, she's a good friend of mine. And anyway, she is a font of knowledge. And she told me that you can't present people with that many options. So if you actually like lower the number of items that are in your online shop, it seems to work. But yeah. So I'll feature different things at different times. But yeah, so when people want to open a conversation, what body of artwork they're interested in, and then we'll shoot them emails back and forth, or my girlfriend / studio manager will shoot them emails back and forth because she's better at that stuff than I am.
Yeah.
Asking them like what they're interested in, and then she'll start tailoring like reports from them that show how the work could look together and stuff like that.
Wow. That's smart. Yeah. That's really smart. Yeah, it's always confusing to figure out like what's the best mode. You know, like you can go on Instagram, but it's a very competitive, weird landscape. One thing though, that like for you, it's like what stood out immediately, like a long time ago, whenever I first found you, is like your name. Just like, I don't know, it's just memorable. Like it stands out. But like, what made you pick that? Because like in choosing branding, it's like you're varying from like using your name or like some of these conventions.
I know they say you're supposed to use your name, right? But I picked it because it's memorable. And plus, I mean, she comes to work with me every day, the dog, Frida.
Yeah.
She reminds me that like my studio doesn't have any windows to the outdoors. So, you know, having her there makes me go outside and get some fresh air every once in a while. So I don't know. It kind of stuck. I don't think I could change it now.
Yeah. How long have you been like full time? Like, because I know you probably had a transitionary period. What were you doing before being a full-time artist?
I also worked in retail management. Oi.
Okay. Yeah.
I worked at Blockbuster before it went under.
Oh, get out. Wow.
I know. I totally did. I managed a Blockbuster. And I also a bookstore up here. I managed bookstores for a long time. Mostly I worked in libraries and bookstores and then at the end, Blockbuster.
Man. These are all fields where they're like kind of obsolete art forms, or they're, you know, things with like more and more niche audiences in the world. But
yeah, I think like, and I think about it a lot. I think like having the full time to do the art has really, I think that's when my career started to turn, was when I had the time to do it full time. Because when I was working, I was just so tired. Like, and that's when I was in the studio in Granville Island. And so you'd be working these like 40, 50 hours a week. And then like after work, you'd try and trudge on down to Granville Island and go to your print co-op and try and do some work. And it was just, you were just so tired that no ideas came. So it wasn't until I think I stopped doing work that things started to take off a bit more. I had more time to devote to it.
Yeah. No, I think that's a really good point. You need room to breathe, you know?
Yeah. And I always tell people like, you know, like it took a long time to figure out what it is that I had to say that was different. And now, you know, it feels like there's not a whole lot of time left to say it. So.
Yeah. Huh, that's an interesting, why not a whole lot of time? Like, are you counting down to something?
Dude, I'm old.
No, you're not that. You're not old. No, I agree though. Like, it's good to have like drive to like keep wanting to say something and keep making your work. And I don't know.
Well, I think like as an artist, I see the work evolving still. Like when I look back at some of the work I did even just a couple of years ago, it feels different than the work that I'm doing now. And I keep thinking of ways for it to alter and change. So I you know, I hope there's enough, well, there's going to be enough time for me to say what I want to say, but I just, you know, it just feels like, you know, I just can't be in there enough.
Mm-hmm. That's really good. That's like a really good headspace to be in. Cause you can just like keep making and you have like momentum behind you, you know?
Yeah. That's what I was scared about with all, you know, people not being able to be at their studios and stuff. I'm thankful that I can still go to mine. Because I think that like once you stop your momentum, it's hard to get it back again.
So I was looking at, on your website, you had a pachacacha that you had done.
Yes.
And I believe that's
scared the shit out of me. Can I say shit?
Yeah. You know, you could, yes.
There was like 600 people in the audience. It was,
wow. That's a big audience. Yeah.
I'm telling like an entire audience that A, that I'm gay, and B, that I have OCD and I count everything. Yeah, yeah. That was super comfortable.
Well, that's what I wanted to ask, because it's, yeah, you're being like super vulnerable and like, and I could tell, I couldn't see it. I think it was just audio that I was listening to, but I could see your slides that you were showing at least. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I couldn't tell like how big the crowd was, but there were a few points where like you slowed down and I could tell you were just like being overwhelmed by like being on stage or...
Oh God. Well, yeah.
You know,
oh, God.
If you're not used to it, especially.
Not that many people. Like I've done presentations and stuff before, but I mean, 600 people, that was a lot of people to come listen to. I mean, I think there were 10 of us speaking that night. So, and they're all very short talks. Right. But, what, like six minutes? But still, like 600 people listening to a printmaker, I'm like, you don't think you have anything that interesting to say. But then I think that's one of those gifts of time, too, where you start realizing that it's not just your art that people are buying. It's also your story and what you have to say is interesting. And so I think, you know, being gay and having OCD, all of that plays into my work as much as I would have probably wanted to deny it before, right?
Mm-hmm. No, yeah, it's all a part of it, you know, in one way or another. But I noticed like the title of your talk, you titled it "Why Being Gay Makes Me a Better Printmaker," right?
True. Yeah.
And I was wondering like, how does it, or what effect does it have? Or is it something that I can see and experience in viewing your work? Like, I was curious just like if you could expand upon that.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I talked about it a bit in the talk too, but, I'd say that, well, like, I don't know if it's fair to say like as printmakers, we often feel like, I'm putting myself in there. God damn it. Yes, I am. We have this like underdog mentality, right? And
yeah.
I'd say, you know, like growing up gay, and I knew I was gay from a really young age. I mentioned in the talk that I got caught kissing a girl in high school, and I don't know what I was thinking. It was this tiny town, like literally 300 people in my high school. It was torture.
Yeah.
But, so I'm familiar with the underdog mentality, I think. But I think having that different thing about myself was also one of the things, like one of the ways that my brain coped, and probably, you know, you can't really do like a complete causality, but why you have OCD or you're on the spectrum. But, for sure, I'd say like that stress played into it for me.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'd think that, and that was the thing that I didn't like to talk about it very much. I didn't like to talk about being gay. I didn't like people, even though, you know, who are we kidding? I can't hide it.
Yeah.
Look at me. Other people can't see me, but look at my Instagram. I'm so obviously gay. What was I thinking? Anyway.
But it was a different time, you know, and
it was different.
It's like not that long ago, but the 80s were just like people treated things differently. Like, I don't know if it was this way in Canada, but like our slang terms, like were often like derogatory kind of gay slurs, like calling something gay was like saying it was lame or...
Yeah.
You know, I think back and like how it was so normal, but like how weird it is now to like think about those cultural things, you know?
And then if you are gay and you hear those words being thrown around in your head, you know that someone's just saying that, but then you also know that, you know, each one is a tiny little cut, right?
Yeah.
It feels like this tiny little insult. And I think you take all those with you on the road, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the thing too, like, and you know, so getting older and like growing up, you start to give people the benefit of the doubt and hope that, you know, society changes and people will know that language is something that's hurtful.
Yeah. Yeah.
So when you look back to all of that stuff, you know, cause the OCD made me in a way, like it makes lino printing, it makes so much more sense. It makes me so drawn to it. So I think, so it all like has this like seed back to the beginning, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like all the threads of your experience coming together in total, yeah. You know?
It's actually my superpower.
Yeah. I love that. That's awesome. Well, that seems like a really good spot to end on, I think. I don't know.
Cool.
I think we did good. Yeah.
Good. I've always like, because like, I know like in your, like I listen to a lot of your podcasts, of course.
Yeah.
And it's often like you talk to people who like run like print studios.
Mm-hmm.
I think like the you know, the difference being that like I was in a print studio for a long time, but then I, you know, kind of broke it on my own because there's that whole thing about trying to like not make it just as a printmaker, but as an artist. I think that's a different mentality, right?
Yeah.
Sometimes.
Yeah.
So part of me was a little worried about, you know, talking about print community, but which I know I've been part of and I obviously am a part of, but it's not quite the same when I'm very much a printmaker, but I'm also an artist.
Well, yeah. And to make your living, it's probably beneficial to frame yourself more as the artist first, as an identity, just because everyone will relate to it and they'll treat you as an equal to like the painter in the booth next to you or something. Or,
mm-hmm.
It's just a weird way it is, but
mm-hmm. We're like kind of shackled in a good way with, it's like an albatross of, having to teach people about print, which is, I'm fine with.
Yeah. It's more like, it's like fuzzy handcuffs, you know? Fuzzy.
Yeah.
but yeah, anyway.
Cool.
Well, yeah. Well, thank you for coming on the Printcast and for sharing about your work and everything.
Thanks for asking me. Thank you.
Well, good luck and hang tight
thank
up
you.
There. And yeah, we'll
Take
talk
care.
To you soon. Take care.
Bye.
Thanks for tuning into the Printcast. Big thanks going out to my guest, Kari Christensen, for coming on the podcast. You can check out her work on Instagram under the name The Printmaker and Her Dog, and online at karichristensen.com. The Printcast has a new website with a few quirks on mobile that I'm working out, but you can find a backlog of episodes and info about the show and about myself at theprintcast.com. Are you loving this print-related content? You can show your support for the show on Patreon for as little as $3 a month at patreon.com/theprintcast. Thanks for listening to The Printcast, and in case you forgot,
this is The Printcast, the best f***ing podcast about printmaking ever made.
You've been listening to The Printcast, a podcast about print shops, the artist, the process, and all the things we make. If you like what you are listening to, help us get the word out by subscribing and leaving a 5-star review and sharing with your friends on social media. You can find The Printcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, as well as on the website printcast.com. Music for the show is by Jazar. Voiceover provided by Jim Birdsall and Rhiannon Birdsall. Take care of yourselves and each other, and we'll see you again on another episode of The Printcast. Bye for now.